you can start your day off right. When you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
Clearly, Governor Abbott knows that federal rules supersede state rules. So why do you think he did this?
Politics. I think it's pretty clear when you make a choice that's against all public health information and data out there, that it's not based on what is in the interest of the people you are governing. It's perhaps in the interest of your own politics.
Governor Greg Abbott's ban on vaccine mandates is setting up a clash between the state of Texas and the Biden administration, with many companies stuck in the middle. The question is, will businesses comply with the governor's order or federal requirements? Plus, lawmakers vote to lift the debt ceiling, but a bigger fight is looming when it comes to a $3.5 trillion spending bill. The question is, how will Democrats shrink their social spending plan? And life imitates art as Hollywood actor William Shatner, famous for playing Captain James T. Kirk on Star Trek, is expected to launch into space later today. The question is, couldn't he have just beamed himself up? It's way too early for this. Good morning, and welcome to Way Too Early, the show that's honored to boldly go into your living room each and every morning. I'm Jonathan Lemire on this Wednesday, October 13th. We'll start with the news. Amid the ongoing debate over coronavirus booster shots, drug maker Moderna is urging the FDA to approve a half dose of its COVID vaccine as a booster. The FDA released a review yesterday suggesting an additional half dose of the Moderna vaccine increased antibody levels in people who had received a two-dose regimen at least 6 months earlier. Despite those findings, FDA reviewers declined to take a stance on whether an additional shot was necessary, saying data shows two doses are still enough to protect against severe disease and death in the United States. Meanwhile, the White House is telling governors across the country to start preparing to vaccinate children as young as five by early November. The move is in anticipation of the FDA's clearing Pfizer's COVID vaccine for children ages 5 to 11 in the coming weeks. The Biden administration has purchased 65 million pediatric doses of the Pfizer vaccine, enough to vaccinate the estimated 20 million children who would be eligible for a shot. Starting next month, the Biden administration will allow fully vaccinated foreign travelers to enter the United States by land. For the first time since March 2020, visitors from Canada or Mexico will be able to come into the U.S. for non-essential purposes, like tourism. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas is expected to formally announce the rules later today. Texas Governor Greg Abbott's executive order barring COVID-19 vaccine mandates by private businesses isn't going over well with some of the state's largest employers. The Wall Street Journal reports both Southwest and American Airlines say they won't follow that order. As federal contractors, they must abide by the Biden administration's federal vaccination mandate. The Journal goes on to report that the Greater Houston Partnership, which represents some 900 companies, including ExxonMobil and JP Morgan Chase, said yesterday that Governor Abbott's order would make it more difficult for Texas businesses to operate safely. The organization has been generally supportive of the president's efforts to require vaccines for large employers. Monday's order was a shift for the Texas governor, who previously maintained that private businesses should set their own employee requirements. Meanwhile, a Florida county administrator is blasting Governor Ron DeSantis after being slapped with a more than $3.5 million fine for implementing an employee vaccine mandate. Leon County's Vince Long calls the move a, quote, political strategy which has nothing to do with the positions we've taken. DeSantis issued the hefty fine against the county last week, following threats to punish local governments for issuing vaccine mandates. The county required all of its employees to get vaccinated by October 1st and subsequently fired 14 people who refused to do so. In a statement, DeSantis' spokeswoman writes in part, quote, the governor will continue fighting for Floridians' rights, and the Florida Department of Health will continue to enforce the law. And White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki is also criticizing those Republican governors for their resistance to vaccine mandates.
Our intention is to implement and continue to work to implement these requirements across the country, including in the states where there are attempts to oppose them. I will say, since you gave me the opportunity, Governor Abbott's executive order banning mandates. And I would also note announcement by Governor DeSantis this morning, essentially banning the implementation of mandates, fit a familiar pattern that we've seen of putting politics ahead of public health. Over 700,000 American lives have been lost due to COVID-19, including more than 56,000 in Florida and over 68,000 in Texas. And every leader should be focused on supporting efforts to save lives and end the pandemic.
Joining us now, my friend and colleague at the Associated Press, White House reporter Darlene Superville. Darlene, thanks so much for getting up and being here this morning. Let's start there with this ongoing fight between some Republican governors and the White House over vaccines and mandates. We've already seen this pushback from these GOP lawmakers unwilling to issue the vaccine mandates for adults. How much resistance is the White House expecting from those same governors and perhaps some parents once children are authorized to get the vaccine?
The White House is probably expecting a similar amount of pushback when it comes to vaccinating children. Remember, there are 70 million or so Americans in this country right now who have not been vaccinated against COVID-19. And presumably many of those people have children. And so a five-year-old cannot walk into the local CVS and just get a vaccine on their own. Their parent or guardian will have to take them. And if the parent doesn't believe in getting vaccinated themselves, it extends to vaccinating the child as well. And so that's where you're going to see probably some pushback when it comes to vaccinating children, as the White House is eager to get that portion of the anti-COVID situation under control.
And certainly, Darlene, as we've been covering, the White House was initially resistant to have some of these mandates. But as the president and his advisors' frustration has grown, and with those who haven't gotten the shots, calling it the pandemic of the unvaccinated, we have seen them use them more and to some success. Certainly, we've heard from them that they're thinking that numbers have gone up because of exactly that. Turning to infrastructure, let's talk about the latest in terms of this $3.5 trillion bill. We know that President Biden has started to make more of a public case for it. He was in Michigan last week. He's going to Connecticut on Friday to hold another event to rally support for the bill. But we know it's also going to shrink. What's the latest reporting in terms of what could come out of that $3.5 trillion bill to get it across the finish line?
Well, you heard the White House say yesterday that it's no longer a $3.5 trillion bill. It's going to be more in the order of $2 trillion. And so House Speaker Nancy Pelosi yesterday said when the size of the bill shrinks, decisions will have to be made about what goes into it. Some of the more liberal members of Congress want a lot of things: climate money, money for climate change, education, childcare, healthcare, and other issues. But when the size of the bill comes down, you have to, choices have to be made about what goes in it. And Speaker Pelosi the other day released a letter to some of her colleagues saying that what she was hearing from her members was that they want to do a few things well instead of trying to do everything that was in the initial $3.5 trillion package. So what we're going to see in the next couple of weeks or so is this kind of give and take between the moderates in the House, moderate Democrats and liberal Democrats who want much more. They're going to have to figure out what goes into the bill and what they can live with, what they can live without.
Certainly watching the progressives will be key on this. And Darlene, one last for you here. What role do we think during these negotiations that President Biden himself will play?
Well, we've seen him step up his engagement in the last couple of weeks on the bill, having members of Congress come to the White House for one-on-one meetings. He had a couple of group meetings with some of the moderate lawmakers, a group of the more liberal lawmakers. And I would expect to see him continue that level of engagement, if not step it up even more. You mentioned an upcoming trip where he will, again, talk about his agenda and what he wants to do for Americans. And I think we'll also see him travel a little bit more as well as continue to engage with lawmakers over the legislation, because they are facing an October 31st deadline. And that's basically around the corner.
The AP's Darlene Superville, thank you so much. I'm sure I'll be talking to you in just a couple hours. Still ahead, a coroner releases the cause of death for Gabby Petito. the 22-year-old who disappeared last month during a cross-country road trip. The latest on the manhunt for her missing fiancé. Plus, a record number of Americans are walking off the job. We're digging into the new numbers released by the Labor Department. Those stories and a check on the weather when we come right back.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angi to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angi app or visit Angi.com today. You can do this when you Angi that.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
We now know what caused the death of 22-year-old Gabby Petito. This comes as police continue the manhunt for her fiancé, Brian Laundrie. NBC News correspondent Kristen Dahlgren has the details.
After an exhaustive autopsy, the Teton County coroner confirming how Gabby Petito was killed.
Caused death by strangulation and manner is homicide.
The coroner says the 22-year-old died 3 to 4 weeks before her body was discovered in the Wyoming wilderness. That would put Petito's death somewhere around the last week of August. The last confirmed sighting of Petito was August 27th, 2 weeks after the Moab police stopped Petito and her boyfriend Brian Laundrie after bystanders reported domestic violence.
I was apologizing to him.
No charges were filed. The coroner says the case is in the hands of investigators and that DNA samples were taken by the FBI.
This autopsy included a whole body CAT scan, a examination by a forensic pathologist. So it was pretty much covered all the bases.
Investigators have been searching for Laundrie for nearly a month, wanted on debit card fraud charges and for questioning in Petito's homicide. After his parents say he went hiking in a local reserve in September and never returned, an attorney for Laundrie called Gabby's death a tragedy, adding, Brian is only considered a person of interest in relation to Gabby Petito's demise. At this time, Brian is still missing, and when he's located, we will address the pending fraud charge against him. No comment from Petito's family as they learn more about her final hours.
The State Department is investigating new complaints of the so-called Havana Syndrome, this time at the U.S. Embassy in Colombia. This comes a week before Secretary of State Antony Blinken is scheduled to visit the South American country. According to the New York Times, it is unclear how many people were affected by the mysterious illness. Symptoms include headaches, nausea, dizziness, and memory loss. Colombia's president says the country would be investigating the reports. So far, more than 200 U.S. government officials have reported symptoms of the Havana syndrome over the past 5 years in several countries. The reason for the symptoms? Unknown. The number of Americans quitting their jobs has surged to record highs. According to new data released by the Labor Department, some 4.3 million people quit in August. That number was driven largely by the food and retail industries. The previous record was set in April of this year, when about 4 million Americans walked off the job. Experts say this is being driven in part by workers who are less willing to endure inconvenient hours or poor compensation, or are seeking better opportunities. According to the Labor Department, there were about 10.4 million job openings in the United States at the end of August. A U.S. task force is recommending that doctors should not prescribe low-dose aspirin to prevent a first heart attack or stroke. The new proposal comes after evidence suggests there is a high risk of serious side effects that outweigh any potential benefit. The updated guidance says that adults in their 40s and 50s should only take aspirin if their doctors determine they are at a higher risk of heart disease. Taking a daily low-dose aspirin has long been recommended for heart health. The panel is also planning to withdraw its recommendation that baby aspirin be taken to prevent colorectal cancer. Still ahead, all the highlights from last night's MLB postseason games. Plus, one NBA star gets sidelined after refusing to take a COVID-19 vaccine. Sports. next.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Why are smart businesses graduating to NetSuite by Oracle? Because NetSuite eliminates the expense of multiple business systems by consolidating your operations together into one. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite reduces IT costs because it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, so you can access it from anywhere. You cut the cost and headaches of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Bringing all your major business processes into one platform improves efficiency, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. You'll see how you'll profit with NetSuite too. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Just go to netsuite.com/podcast25 for more information. That's netsuite.com/podcast25.
And most importantly for the Astros, they are one out away. Ground ball right side, waiting on Altuve. He has it from the outfield grass, throws to first, and that is the ball game, and that is the division series.
The Houston Astros are headed to the American League Championship Series for the fifth straight year. Houston, bouncing back from a 12-6 loss on Sunday, eliminated the Chicago White Sox with a 10-1 victory in Game 4 of their ALDS Series yesterday. The Astros, who were disciplined for a sign-stealing scandal in 2019, will host the Boston Red Sox in Game 1, the best-of-7 ALCS Friday night. Welcome to the Red Sox bandwagon, the rest of America. To Atlanta, and a back-and-forth affair between the Brewers and the Braves in Game 4 of their National League Division Series. The Braves, coming back from a pair of two-run deficits before Milwaukee, needing a win to stay alive, sent out All-Star closer Josh Hader to pitch the eighth inning with the game tied at 4.
Two down in the eighth. Freddie Freeman with the Brewers in a shift. It's a fly ball to center field. Lorenzo Cain going back at the wall. Freddie Freeman's left the yard and put the Braves on top in the bottom of the eighth.
Hader, who is usually so good, but no match there for the 2020 National League MVP, Freddie Freeman. Freeman with a two-out first-pitch home run to give Atlanta the lead. The Braves hang on to beat the Brewers 5-4. They've done all this without their best player, Ronald Acuna. And they now advance to the National League Championship Series for the second year in a row. Atlanta will face the winner of the other National League Division Series between the Giants and Dodgers. Those teams now headed into a decisive Game 5. That's going to be so much fun. After the Dodgers even the series with a 7-2 victory at home over San Francisco last night. Back to the Bay Area tomorrow, Giants will host the Dodgers in Game 5. The stalemate between the NBA and players who refused to be vaccinated took a significant turn yesterday after the Brooklyn Nets issued an ultimatum for star point guard Kyrie Irving that bars him from all games and practices unless he gets the shot. The Nets making clear that Irving will not have part-time availability with his decision not to comply with New York City's vaccine mandate, stating anyone entering an indoor gym, including the team's home arena at the Barclays Center, must have at least one dose. The team's decision to sit Irving also for the road games that he's eligible to play sets the stage for a potential battle between the team and the players' union, which, according to the New York Times, has already been pushing back on the league's plan to dock the pay of unvaccinated players for games they miss because of ordinances in their home cities. Irving, who, mind you, has also suggested that the earth is flat, is due to lose about $380,000 for every home game he misses, but he'll still be paid for the road games. Time now for the weather. Let's go to meteorologist Bill Cairns. Bill, how you doing today, and what's the weather looking like?
I'm doing well, but it's really unfortunate that someone has to win that series between the Astros and Red Sox.
Wait a
for a Yankee fan, that's a very difficult proposition.
Wait a minute. Now, I've heard the comparisons. Willie Geist was out here yesterday suggesting that if it's Red Sox-Astros, this is the only possible scenario, he would root for the Red Sox. I know others have compared this to the battle between others have said this is the battle between the measles and the mumps. To all you people, you're wrong. The Red Sox, the Astros are the team that got disciplined and had people fired. I'm ignoring Alex Cora's role in this.
All right.
Root for the Sox.
All right. You've had this speech prepared for a while.
Yeah, it's
all right. So let's get into this forecast today. So we had this blizzard going on in Wyoming. So this has been a pretty significant winter storm. We also had numerous tornadoes reported yesterday in areas of West Texas and in Oklahoma. Not too much damage was done. I heard reports of one barn that was destroyed. We don't have any injuries or any fatalities. So we still have this line of storms that's waking a lot of people up in the middle of the night through central Kansas. It just went through Wichita. It's soon going to be heading through Oklahoma City. There's a lot of lightning and thunder with this line of storms and possibility of some damaging winds still. It will weaken as it approaches Kansas City early this morning. And then at the same time, we have Hurricane Pamela. This one is moving from the Pacific into areas of north central Mexico. And the only big significance that this storm has, it's a low-end Category 1 hurricane, but all of the rain from this is going to be sucked northwards into that storm in the middle of the country. So although this storm, Pamela, not going to cause a ton of damage even in Mexico, all that rain from that storm is headed for Texas as we go throughout the next 24 to 36 hours. So we could have some locally heavy rain, especially north of Laredo. Even the Dallas area to Waco to Austin could pick up a quick 2 to 3 inches, isolated 5 to 7 possible. And because of that, we do have a flash flood watch that's up in effect for 12 million people from southern Oklahoma through Dallas, down through Waco and Austin, and includes the San Antonio area. So we'll wait and see how that develops later on today and tomorrow for that heavy rain threat. The other story, just the incredible warmth continues, and it's one of those rare days where Boston will be warmer than Phoenix, Arizona, and LA. It's better today in Boston than almost anywhere. 77 degrees and sunny. Doesn't happen all that often, so soak it up and enjoy it. Still the storms today from Texas all the way through the Midwest. The only chilly weather's in the Rockies where we still have that snowstorm ongoing. And tomorrow, we do it again in the Northeast. I mean, D.C. at 82 degrees tomorrow. Shorts and T-shirt weather continues, Jonathan, well now into the middle of October.
82 degrees. Come on. Bill Cairns, thank you so much.
I know.
Still ahead, Democrats are weighing how to scale back their $3.5 trillion social spending plan. But will everyone in that building get on the same page when it comes to trimming the price tag? We'll have the latest from Capitol Hill. But before we go to break, we want to know, just why are you awake? Email your reasons to waytooearly@msnbc.com or tweet me at John Lemire, no H there. And be sure to use the hashtag waytooearly. We'll read our favorite answers later in the show. Welcome back to Way Too Early. It's just a smidge before 5:30 on the East Coast, 2:30 out West. I'm Jonathan Lemire. House Democrats cast their votes to stop an economic disaster and extend the U.S. debt ceiling. The vote was along party lines, with every yes coming from Democrats and no Republicans backing the measure. Without the extension, the country was days away from the first default in its history. The Senate narrowly voted to raise the borrowing limit last week after fierce opposition from Republicans. The bill will only stave off default until December, when it will need to be addressed again. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is preparing Democrats for potential cuts to their $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. Pelosi warned of the future compromises at her weekly press briefing, stressing the caucus would work to make sure the changes wouldn't stop the package from being, quote, transformative.
We have some important decisions to make in the next few days so that we can proceed. I'm very disappointed that we're not going with the original $3.5 trillion, which was very transformative. Whatever we do, it will be transformative. It will produce results. And we are very grateful to our president for saying, I want to pass the bipartisan legislation on infrastructure, but I will not confine my vision for the future to what can be in that bill. Hence, we need the Build Back Better.
The Washington Post reports that Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema's opposition has set off a frenzy of talks that increasingly have involved President Biden, who personally has warned Democrats in recent days that their package is likely to be less than the $3.5 trillion. Progressives, originally adamant that the higher price tag was necessary, have accepted discussions of cutting down the cost. But they remain insistent that many of their priorities are non-negotiable and that moderates need to counter their offer.
We continue to be upfront about our priorities and clear about what we've understood our mandate from the voters to be. We are waiting for just a couple of senators to tell us what their proposal is.
We are prepared to negotiate. We're prepared to compromise. But we are not going to negotiate with ourselves. $3.5 trillion is already a major compromise. In my view, much too little, given the enormous problems facing us in terms of climate. And the time is now long overdue for Senators Manchin and Senator Sinema to tell us exactly where they are spending. What do they want to cut?
To walk us through this, joining us now, thankfully, the co-founder of Punchbowl News, Anna Palmer. She is an MSNBC contributor. Hey, good morning. Thanks again for being here. Let's start with the debt limit. Will, you know, there's crisis averted for now, but will Democrats be forced to include the debt limit in the reconciliation bill in the weeks ahead?
Yeah, it's been really interesting to watch the body language of top leaders on Capitol Hill. This week in particular, you've had Steny Hoyer, the number two House Democrat, as well as Speaker Pelosi, being fairly open to adding, raising the debt limit to the reconciliation package. This is very different than where they were even a couple of weeks ago. I think now it's almost as if it's a foregone conclusion because they realize that Republicans are not going to help them out of this next kind of deadline of raising the debt limit by sometime in mid-December to early January.
So we just talked about how the spending bill, the Build Back Better agenda, is going to have to shrink. So just give us a couple points here in terms of like what right now might be the target size of this package. What sort of things may fall out or definitely stay in? And also talk to us about the timing of this. These are programs that could be extended over years, right? Which I feel like is maybe an overlooked aspect of this package.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very complicated right now. I don't think you can overstate how Democrats are nowhere. There is no top line number where we understand that the progressives and the moderates are going to be able to compromise on. The number that you hear talked about a lot is it's somewhere between $1.5 and $2.5 trillion. But what we've been hearing on Capitol Hill is the progressives really hardening their stance. Oftentimes we talk about how Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, you know, this is the demands that they're going to make. This is where they're at. But right now the progressives are saying there are some non-negotiables here. Most importantly, this Medicare coverage that would expand coverage for dental, hearing, vision. This is something that costs a lot of money. And right now we have progressives like Bernie Sanders saying that must be in this. That costs a ton of money. So I think that's something to look at as one of the bargaining chips. Where do progressives and the moderates come down on that? The timing is very critical here. The speaker has said that October 31st is the deadline because that's when the surface transportation money runs out. But that's not actually the deadline. They could push this for at least another month or two. I think we're probably teeing up more of an end of the year discussion, coupling the overall reconciliation package with the fact that they're going to have to raise the debt limit. It seems much more likely than them actually getting to a decision point by the end of the month.
So we've been talking about how President Biden has taken a little more of a public role in this, trying to sell this package back on the road after largely remaining in Washington for a few weeks. But talk to us about the lawmakers on Capitol Hill, those Democrats who you're trying to get this done. But part of this calculation is obviously trying to get this done in order to have something to run on so they can run as they go for re-election next year. How much of that right now is their calculation? Do they feel like moderates, progressives alike, do they feel like, hey, I'm going to face voters again in just a little over a year. I need to get this done.
I mean, just ask Terry McAuliffe, who's running for governor of Virginia, how important it is that Democrats pass this bipartisan infrastructure package to his election success in the coming days. I do think, though, we had an interesting comment in Punchbowl News AM from Congresswoman Jayapal, which said a lot of people ask her if something is better than nothing, and she said no. That is a pretty stunning statement about just where progressives are right now, because I think a lot of folks at the White House, a lot of moderates, a lot of members in Democratic leadership would say, actually, no, that's not. Something is better than nothing here, because we are going to be facing a very tough midterm election. Look at Joe Biden's you know, popularity and unpopularity and how it waned in the coming, you know, in the last several months. And so this is going to be one of those real decision points. If, for instance, Terry McAuliffe loses that Virginia governor's race, that would be a pretty big bellwether for Democrats. And I think increase the pressure for something to get done. Without that, we'll see where they end up in terms of the negotiations.
Terry McAuliffe had certainly had a memorable appearance on Morning Joe yesterday. But you're right. We should be watching that tone from the progressive camp in the days and weeks ahead. Anna Palmer, Punchbowl News, thank you as always. Still ahead, William Shatner readies to boldly go where no Hollywood actor has gone before. Plus, the totally different move by the FDA when it comes to a major public health debate. Way Too Early, back in just a minute. Time now for something totally different. It's all systems go for the Blue Origin launch that will take actor William Shatner to space. The NS-18 mission will carry the actor, two paying customers, and one staff member from Blue Origin to the edge of space in a 10-minute flight. The New Shepard rocket, mind you, not the USS Enterprise, was originally rescheduled to launch on Tuesday, but high winds delayed it. The winds have now subsided, and the launch is scheduled for 10 a.m. Eastern today from Van Horn, Texas. You can watch that launch right here on MSNBC, starting at 9:45 Eastern. In other firsts, the Food and Drug Administration has authorized an electronic cigarette to be sold in the United States. The agency greenlit the device in tobacco cartridges, a significant turn in one of the most contentious public health debates in decades. In a statement, the FDA wrote, quote, "The authorized product's aerosols are significantly less toxic than combusted cigarettes based on available data. The FDA determined that the potential benefit to smokers who switch completely or significantly reduce their cigarette use would outweigh the risk to youth." I guess we'll see. According to Netflix, the popular South Korean show Squid Game is officially its biggest series launch ever. The streaming giant made the announcement on Twitter, sharing that 111 million subscribers have tuned in to watch the dystopian drama since its release last month, beating out the previous top show, Bridgerton, which hit 82 million in its first 28 days. Squid Game is also credited with helping Netflix stock reach a record high earlier this month, with shares surging 6% since its release. This comes as the company seeks to invest more in South Korean original content, with plans to spend $500 million this year alone. In a surprising turn of events, California's music and arts festival, Coachella, is reversing its plan to require vaccinations for next year's events. Are we sure this is a good idea? Instead, attendees must show proof of a negative COVID test taken within 72 hours of the festival, or proof of vaccination. The announcement was made through Instagram stories on Coachella's official page, citing low transmission data and successful safety protocols at other festivals for the change. This festival is scheduled for April of next year. Still ahead, time is running out for four members of the Trump administration to answer subpoenas issued by the House committee tasked with investigating the attack on the Capitol. And as we go to break, a look at this date in history. 61 years ago, John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon held the third televised debate of their famous presidential campaign.
The two candidates will not be sharing the same platform. In New York, the Democratic presidential nominee, Senator John F. Kennedy. Separated by 3,000 miles in a Los Angeles studio, the Republican presidential nominee, Vice President Richard M. Nixon.
The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol will impose criminal contempt charges against those who do not comply with its subpoenas, according to Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney of Wyoming, the panel's vice chair. The committee late last month subpoenaed four members of former President Donald Trump's administration, including former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and former White House advisor Steve Bannon, who has already declared he will not comply with the subpoena. That's according to NBC News. Maryland Congressman and Select Committee member Jamie Raskin implied in a tweet that those who defy the subpoenas may have more to fear than just charges, saying they will face, quote, referral for criminal prosecution at the very least. Joining us now, legal scholar and advocate Jennifer Taub. She is a Western New England University School of Law professor, and her book, Big Dirty Money, is out now in paperback. Jennifer, good morning. Thanks so much for being here. Let's start with what might be on Congressman Raskin's mind. What other measures might force compliance without criminal prosecution or be an additional measure of punishment if one of the former Trump officials is charged?
Good morning, Jonathan. As it happens, Congressman Raskin was also a law professor, and so he knows the three options that Congress has. One that you mentioned was having the committee go to Nancy Pelosi and use the criminal contempt statute, which is 2 USC 192. And under that statute and the subsequent 194, what happens is if the referral is made by Pelosi to the attorney general, he actually has a duty to bring it to a grand jury. And with that criminal sanction comes up to 1 year in prison and a up to $100,000 fine. So that's one option. The other two options, I think you've heard about a lot of talk about this thing called inherent contempt. I'm very doubtful that would be used. That's where the committee and the House would call on the sergeant of arms to imprison somebody for not either showing up to answer questions or producing documents. That doesn't seem likely. So the third option is just pursuing a civil case. And we've seen that before. It's my expectation, based on what we heard Congresswoman Lynn Cheney saying last night, that this special committee is uniform in their desire to hold people like Bannon accountable. And I would expect they will actually make that referral if he does not begin to cooperate.
It's going to be really interesting to watch in the coming days. Turning more to your wheelhouse, senior DOJ official John Carlin yesterday announced new measures to combat white-collar crime. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this was a really interesting speech he gave. Actually, it's only getting attention right now, but it happened last week. He gave a speech to a virtual audience via Zoom, an audience of corporate criminal defense attorneys. And what was incredibly surprising about this speech is how forthright he was in saying that, you know, the party is over now for elite corporate criminals, that this administration, the Biden administration and obviously the Garland DOJ, is no longer going to coddle repeat offenders. And they will use the power they have and the new resources they're going to apply to make sure that businesses stay on the up and up. And this was, you know, for those of us who noticed it, I mean, there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal about it, but not many people paid attention. But those who follow this area of law were very impressed with Carlin's speech. I mean, it hit all the right notes, and it made clear that he has the backing of both his direct boss, the deputy attorney general, Lisa Monaco, who's a former Enron prosecutor, and obviously the backing of Merrick Garland. I was incredibly pleased and relieved by this speech.
All right. Well, Jennifer Taub, thank you so much for helping bring it to our attention. We'll see you again soon. Earlier in the show, we asked, why are you awake? One viewer writes, I'm up way too early because my cat decided it was time to go into labor. These guys are going to be as adorable as their older brothers and sister. Another viewer is not up way too early, writing, it's 12:30 p.m. here in Romania. Been awake for a long time. Good morning, Jonathan. And thank you for helping with our vital Romania demographics. And Susie emails, so much for being empty nesters. My husband is up comforting the dog we intended to foster, only to adopt. And I should also note, we received a deluge of notes from angry Astros fans. I stand by every word I said. Go Sox. Up next, a look at the Axios One Big Thing. And coming up on Morning Joe, a member of the January 6th Select Committee, Congresswoman Stephanie Murphy, will join the conversation. Plus, we'll hear from Michigan's Attorney General amid continued efforts by Republicans in her state to cast doubt on the election results. Mike Barnicle also will be here. Morning Joe is just moments away.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.